5. Logical catalactics versus mathematical catalactics. The problems of prices and costs have been treated also with mathematical methods. There have even been economists who held that the only appropriate method of dealing with economic problems is the mathematical method, and who derided the logical economists as literary economists. If this antagonism between the logical and the mathematical economists were merely a disagreement concerning the most adequate procedure to be applied in the study of economics, it would be superfluous to pay attention to it. The better method would prove its preeminence by bringing about better results. It may also be that different varieties of procedure are necessary for the solution of different problems, and that for some of them, one method is more useful than the other. However, this is not a dispute about heuristic questions, but a controversy concerning the foundations of economics. The mathematical method must be rejected not only on account of its barrenness. It is an entirely vicious method, starting from false assumptions and leading to fallacious inferences. Its syllogisms are not only sterile, they divert the mind from the study of the real problems and distort the relations between the various phenomena. The ideas and procedures of the mathematical economists are not uniform. There are three main currents of thought which must be dealt with separately. The first variety is represented by the statisticians who aim at discovering economic laws from the study of economic experience. They aim to transform economics into a quantitative science. Their program is condensed in the motto of the Econometric Society: Science is measurement. The fundamental error implied in this reasoning has been shown above. Experience of economic history is always experience of complex phenomena. It can never convey knowledge of the kind the experimenter abstracts from a laboratory experiment. Statistics is a method for the presentation of historical facts concerning prices and other relevant data of human action. It is not economics, and cannot produce economic theorems and theories. The statistics of prices is economic history. The insight that, ceteris paribus, an increase in demand must result in an increase in prices is not derived from experience. Nobody ever was or ever will be in a position to observe a change in one of the market data, ceteris paribus. There is no such thing as quantitative economics. All economic quantities we know about are data of economic history. No reasonable man can contend that the relations between price and supply is in general, or in respect of certain commodities, constant. We know, on the contrary, that external phenomena affect different people in different ways, that the reactions of the same people to the same external events vary, and that it is not possible to assign individuals to classes of men reacting in the same way. This insight is a product of our a prioristic theory. It is true the empiricists reject this theory. They pretend that they aim to learn only from historical experience. However, they contradict their own principles as soon as they pass beyond the unadulterated recording of individual single prices and begin to construct series and to compute averages. A datum of experience and a statistical fact is only a price paid at a definite time and a definite place for a definite quantity of a certain commodity. The arrangement of various price data in groups and the computation of averages are guided by theoretical deliberations which are logically and temporally antecedent. The extent to which certain attending features and circumstantial contingencies of the price data concerned are taken or not taken into consideration depends on theoretical reasoning of the same kind. Nobody is so bold as to maintain that a rise of a percent in the supply of any commodity must always, in every country and at any time, result in a fall of b percent in its price. But as no quantitative economist ever ventured to define precisely on the ground of statistical experience the special conditions producing a definite deviation from the ratio A to B, the futility of his endeavors is manifest. Moreover, money is not a standard for the measurement of prices. It is a medium whose exchange ratio varies in the same way, although, as a rule, not with the same speed and to the same extent in which the mutual exchange ratios of the vendable commodities and services vary. There is hardly any need to dwell longer upon the exposure of the claims of quantitative economics. In spite of all the high-sounding pronouncements of its advocates, nothing has been done for the realization of its program. The late Henry Schultz devoted his research to the measurement of elasticities of demand for various commodities. Professor Paul H. Douglas has praised the outcome of Schultz's studies as a work as necessary to help make economics a more or less exact science as was the determination of atomic weights for the development of chemistry. The truth is that Schultz never embarked upon a determination of the elasticity of demand for any commodity as such. The data he relied upon were limited to certain geographical areas and historical periods. His results for a definite commodity, for instance, potatoes, do not refer to potatoes in general, but to potatoes in the United States in the years from 1875 to 1929. They are, at best, rather questionable and unsatisfactory contributions to various chapters of economic history. They are certainly not steps toward the realization of the confused and contradictory program of quantitative economics. It must be emphasized that the two other varieties of mathematical economics are fully aware of the futility of quantitative economics, for they have never ventured to make any magnitudes, as found by the econometricians, enter into their formulas and equations, and thus to adapt them for the solution of particular problems. There is in the field of human action no means of dealing with future events other than that provided by understanding. The second field treated by mathematical economists is that of the relation of prices and costs. In dealing with these problems, the mathematical economists disregard the operation of the market process, and moreover, pretend to abstract from the use of money inherent in all economic calculations. However, as they speak of prices and costs in general, and confront prices and costs, they tacitly imply the existence and the use of money. Prices are always money prices, and costs cannot be taken into account in economic calculation if not expressed in terms of money. If one does not resort to terms of money, costs are expressed in complex quantities of diverse goods and services to be expended for the procurement of a product. On the other hand, prices, if this term is applicable at all to exchange ratios determined by barter, are the enumeration of quantities of various goods against which the seller can exchange a definite supply. The goods which are referred to in such prices are not the same to which the costs refer. A comparison of such prices in kind and costs in kind is not feasible. That the seller values the goods he gives away less than those he receives in exchange for them, that the seller and the buyer disagree with regard to the subjective valuation of the two goods exchanged, and that an entrepreneur embarks upon a project only if he expects to receive for the product goods that he values higher than those expended in their production. All this we know already on the ground of praxeological comprehension. It is this a prioristic knowledge that enables us to anticipate the conduct of an entrepreneur who is in a position to resort to economic calculation. But the mathematical economist deludes himself when he pretends to treat these problems in a more general way by omitting any reference to terms of money. It is vain to investigate instances of non-perfect divisibility of factors of production without reference to economic calculation in terms of money. Such a scrutiny can never go beyond the knowledge already available, namely that every entrepreneur is intent upon producing those articles, the sale of which will bring him proceeds that he values higher than the total complex of goods expended in their production. But if there is no indirect exchange, and if no medium of exchange is in common use, he can succeed, provided he has correctly anticipated the future state of the market, only if he is endowed with a superhuman intellect. He would have to take in at a glance all exchange ratios determined at the market in such a way as to assign in his deliberations precisely the place due to every good according to these ratios. It cannot be denied that all investigations concerning the relation of prices and costs presuppose both the use of money and the market process. But the mathematical economists shut their eyes to this obvious fact. They formulate equations and draw curves which are supposed to describe reality. In fact, they describe only a hypothetical and unrealizable state of affairs, in no way similar to the catalactic problems in question. They substitute algebraic symbols for the determinate terms of money as used in economic calculation, and believe that this procedure renders their reasoning more scientific. They strongly impress the gullible layman. In fact, they only confuse and muddle things which are satisfactorily dealt with in textbooks of commercial arithmetic and accountancy. Some of these mathematicians have gone so far as to declare that economic calculation could be established on the basis of units of utility. They call their methods utility analysis. Their error is shared by the third variety of mathematical economics. The characteristic mark of this third group is that they are openly and consciously intent upon solving catalactic problems without any reference to the market process. Their ideal is to construct an economic theory according to the pattern of mechanics. They again and again resort to analogies with classical mechanics, which, in their opinion, is the unique and absolute model of scientific inquiry. There is no need to explain again why this analogy is superficial and misleading, and in what respects purposive human action radically differs from motion, the subject matter of mechanics. It is enough to stress one point, namely the practical significance of the differential equations in both fields. The deliberations which result in the formulation of an equation are necessarily of a non-mathematical character. The formulation of the equation is the consummation of our knowledge. It does not directly enlarge our knowledge. Yet in mechanics, the equation can render very important practical services. As there exist constant relations between various mechanical elements, and as these relations can be ascertained by experiments, it becomes possible to use equations for the solution of definite technological problems. Our modern industrial civilization is mainly an accomplishment of this utilization of the differential equations of physics. No such constant relations exist, however, between economic elements. The equations formulated by mathematical economics remain a useless piece of mental gymnastics, and would remain so even if they were to express much more than they really do. A sound economic deliberation must never forget these two fundamental principles of the theory of value. First, valuing that results in action always means preferring and setting aside. It never means equivalence. Second, there is no means of comparing the valuations of different individuals or the valuations of the same individuals at different instants, other than by establishing whether or not they arrange the alternatives in question in the same order of preference. In the imaginary construction of the evenly rotating economy, all factors of production are employed in such a way that each of them renders the most valuable service. No thinkable and possible change could improve the state of satisfaction. No factor is employed for the satisfaction of a need A if this employment prevents the satisfaction of a need B that is considered more valuable than the satisfaction of A. It is, of course, possible to describe this imaginary state of the allocation of resources in differential equations and to visualize it graphically in curves. But such devices do not assert anything about the market process. They merely mark out an imaginary situation in which the market process would cease to operate. The mathematical economists disregard the whole theoretical elucidation of the market process and evasively amuse themselves with an auxiliary notion employed in its context and devoid of any sense when used outside of this context. In physics, we are faced with changes occurring in various sense phenomena. We discover a regularity in the sequence of these changes, and these observations lead us to the construction of a science of physics. We know nothing about the ultimate forces actuating these changes. They are for the searching mind ultimately given and defy any further analysis. What we know from observation is the regular concatenation of various observable entities and attributes. It is this mutual interdependence of data that the physicist describes in differential equations. In praxeology, the first fact we know is that men are purposively intent upon bringing about some changes. It is this knowledge that integrates the subject matter of praxeology and differentiates it from the subject matter of the natural sciences. We know the forces behind the changes, and this a prioristic knowledge leads us to a cognition of the praxeological processes. The physicist does not know what electricity is. He knows only phenomena attributed to something called electricity. But the economist knows what actuates the market process. It is only thanks to this knowledge that he is in a position to distinguish market phenomena from other phenomena and to describe the market process. Now, the mathematical economist does not contribute anything to the elucidation of the market process. He merely describes an auxiliary makeshift employed by the logical economists as a limiting notion, the definition of a state of affairs in which there is no longer any action and the market process has come to a standstill. That is all he can say. What the logical economist sets forth in words when defining the imaginary constructions of the final state of rest and the evenly rotating economy, and what the mathematical economist himself must describe in words before he embarks upon his mathematical work, is translated into algebraic symbols. A superficial analogy is spun out too long. That is all. Both the logical and the mathematical economists assert that human action ultimately aims at the establishment of such a state of equilibrium, and would reach it if all further changes in data were to cease. But the logical economist knows much more than that. He shows how the activities of enterprising men, the promoters and speculators, eager to profit from discrepancies in the price structure, tend toward eradicating such discrepancies, and thereby also toward blotting out the sources of entrepreneurial profit and loss. He shows how this process would finally result in the establishment of the evenly rotating economy. This is the task of economic theory. The mathematical description of various states of equilibrium is mere play. The problem is the analysis of the market process. A comparison of both methods of economic analysis makes us understand the meaning of the often raised request to enlarge the scope of economic science by the construction of a dynamic theory instead of the mere occupation with static problems. With regard to logical economics, this postulate is devoid of any sense. Logical economics is essentially a theory of processes and changes. It resorts to the imaginary constructions of changelessness merely for the elucidation of the phenomena of change. But it is different with mathematical economics. Its equations and formula are limited to the description of states of equilibrium and non-acting. It cannot assert anything with regard to the formation of such states and their transformation into other states, as long as it remains in the realm of mathematical procedures. As against mathematical economics, the request for a dynamic theory is well substantiated. But there is no means for mathematical economics to comply with this request. The problems of process analysis, that is, the only economic problems that matter, defy any mathematical approach. The introduction of time parameters into the equations is no solution. It does not even indicate the essential shortcomings of the mathematical method. The statements that every change involves time and that change is always in the temporal sequence are merely a way of expressing the fact that as far as there is rigidity and unchangeability, there is no time. The main deficiency of mathematical economics is not the fact that it ignores the temporal sequence, but that it ignores the operation of the market process. The mathematical method is at a loss to show how, from a state of non-equilibrium, those actions spring up which tend toward the establishment of equilibrium. It is, of course, possible to indicate the mathematical operations required for the transformation of the mathematical description of a definite state of non-equilibrium into the mathematical description of the state of equilibrium. But these mathematical operations by no means describe the market process actuated by the discrepancies in the price structure. The differential equations of mechanics are supposed to describe precisely the motions concerned at any instant of the time traveled through. The economic equations have no reference whatever to conditions as they really are in each instant of the time interval between the state of non-equilibrium and that of equilibrium. Only those entirely blinded by the prepossession that economics must be a pale replica of mechanics will underrate the weight of this objection. A very imperfect and superficial metaphor is not a substitute for the services rendered by logical economics. In every chapter of Catalactics, the devastating consequences of the mathematical treatment of economics can be tested. It is enough to refer to two instances only. One is provided by the so-called equation of exchange, the mathematical economist's futile and misleading attempt to deal with changes in the purchasing power of money. The second can be best expressed in referring to Professor Schumpeter's dictum according to which consumers in evaluating consumers' goods, ipso facto, also evaluate the means of production which enter into the production of these goods. It is hardly possible to construe the market process in a more erroneous way. Economics is not about goods and services. It is about the actions of living men. Its goal is not to dwell upon imaginary constructions such as equilibrium. These constructions are only tools of reasoning. the sole task of economics is analysis of the actions of men, is the analysis of processes. 6. Monopoly prices. Competitive prices are the outcome of a complete adjustment of the sellers to the demand of the consumers. Under the competitive price, the whole supply available is sold, and the specific factors of production are employed to the extent permitted by the prices of the non-specific complementary factors. No part of a supply available is permanently withheld from the market, and the marginal unit of specific factors of production employed does not yield any net proceed. The whole economic process is conducted for the benefit of the consumers. There is no conflict between the interests of the buyers and those of the sellers, between the interests of the producers and those of the consumers. The owners of the various commodities are not in a position to divert consumption and production from the lines enjoined by the state of supply of goods and services of all orders and the state of technological knowledge. Every single seller would see his own proceeds increased if a fall in the supply at the disposal of his competitors were to increase the price at which he himself could sell his own supply. But on a competitive market, he is not in a position to bring about this outcome. Except for a privilege derived from government interference with business, he must submit to the state of the market as it is. The entrepreneur, in his entrepreneurial capacity, is always subject to the full supremacy of the consumers. It is different with the owners of vendable goods and factors of production, and, of course, with the entrepreneurs in their capacity as owners of such goods and factors. Under certain conditions, they fare better by restricting supply and selling it at a higher price per unit. The prices thus determined, the monopoly prices, are an infringement of the supremacy of the consumers and the democracy of the market. The special conditions and circumstances required for the emergence of monopoly prices and their catalactic features are: 1. There must prevail a monopoly of supply. The whole supply of the monopolized commodity is controlled by a single seller or a group of sellers acting in concert. The monopolist, whether one individual or a group of individuals, is in a position to restrict the supply offered for sale or employed for production in order to raise the price per unit sold, and need not fear that his plan will be frustrated by interference on the part of other sellers of the same commodity. 2. Either the monopolist is not in a position to discriminate among the buyers, or he voluntarily abstains from such discrimination. 3. The reaction of the buying public to the rise in prices beyond the potential competitive price, the fall in demand, is not such as to render the proceeds resulting from total sales at any price exceeding the competitive price smaller than total proceeds resulting from total sales at the competitive price. Hence, it is superfluous to enter into sophisticated disquisitions concerning what must be considered the mark of the sameness of an article. It is not necessary to raise the question whether all neckties are to be called specimens of the same article, or whether one should distinguish them with regard to fabric, color, and pattern. An academic delimitation of various articles is useless. The only point that counts is the way in which the buyers react to the rise in prices. For the theory of monopoly price, it is irrelevant to observe that every necktie manufacturer turns out different articles and to call each of them a monopolist. Catalactics does not deal with monopoly as such, but with monopoly prices. A seller of neckties which are different from those offered for sale by other people could attain monopoly prices only if the buyers did not react to any rise in prices in such a way as to make such a rise disadvantageous for him. Monopoly is a prerequisite for the emergence of monopoly prices, but it is not the only prerequisite. There is a further condition required, namely a certain shape of the demand curve. The mere existence of monopoly does not mean anything. The publisher of a copyright book is a monopolist, but he may not be able to sell a single copy, no matter how low the price he asks. Not every price at which a monopolist sells a monopolized commodity is a monopoly price. Monopoly prices are only prices at which it is more advantageous for the monopolist to restrict the total amount to be sold than to expand his sales to the limit which a competitive market would allow. They are the outcome of a deliberate design tending toward a restriction of trade. In calling the monopolist's conduct deliberate, it is not meant to suggest that he compares the monopoly price he is asking with the competitive price which a hypothetical non-monopolized market would have determined. It is only the economist who contrasts the monopoly price with the potential competitive price. In the deliberations of the monopolist who has already got his monopolistic position, the competitive price plays no role at all. Like every other seller, he wants to realize the highest price attainable. It is only the state of the market, as conditioned by his monopolistic position on the one hand, and the conduct of the buyers on the other, that results in the emergence of monopoly prices. 4. It is a fundamental mistake to assume that there is a third category of prices, which are neither monopoly prices nor competitive prices. If we disregard the problem of price discrimination to be dealt with later, a definite price is either a competitive price or a monopoly price. The assertions to the contrary are due to the erroneous belief that competition is not free or perfect unless everybody is in a position to present himself as a seller of a definite commodity. The available supply of every commodity is limited. If it were not scarce with regard to the demand of the public, the thing in question would not be considered an economic good, and no price would be paid for it. It is therefore misleading to apply the concept of monopoly in such a way as to make it cover the entire field of economic goods. Mere limitation of supply is the source of economic value and of all prices paid. As such, it is not yet sufficient to generate monopoly prices. The term monopolistic or imperfect competition is applied today to the cases in which there are some differences in the products of different producers and sellers. This means that almost all consumers' goods are included in the class of monopolized goods. However, the only question relevant in the study of the determination of prices is whether these differences can be used by the seller for a scheme of deliberate restriction of supply for the sake of increasing his total net proceeds. Only if this is possible and put into effect can monopoly prices emerge as differentiated from competitive prices. It may be true that every seller has a clientele which prefers his brand to those of his competitors, and would not stop buying it even if the price were higher. But the problem for the seller is whether the number of such people is great enough to overcompensate the reduction of total sales which the abstention from buying on the part of other people would bring about. Only if this is the case can he consider the substitution of monopoly prices for competitive prices advantageous. The confusion which led to the idea of imperfect or monopolistic competition stems from a misinterpretation of the term control of supply. Every producer of every product has his share in controlling the supply of all commodities offered for sale. If he had produced more A, he would have increased supply and brought about a tendency toward a lower price. But the question is why he did not produce more of A. Was he, in restricting his production of A to the amount of P, intent upon complying to the best of his abilities with the wishes of the consumers? Or was he intent upon defying the orders of the consumers for his own advantage? In the first case, he did not produce more of A because increasing the quantity of A beyond P would have withdrawn scarce factors of production from other branches in which they would have been employed for the satisfaction of more urgent needs of the consumers. He does not produce P plus R, but merely P, because such an increase would have rendered his business unprofitable, or less profitable, while there are still other more profitable employments available for capital investment. In the second case, he did not produce R because it was more advantageous for him to leave a part of the available supply of a monopolized specific factor of production, M, unused. If M were not monopolized by him, it would have been impossible for him to expect any advantage from restricting his production of A. His competitors would have filled the gap, and he would not have been in a position to ask higher prices. In dealing with monopoly prices, we must always search for the monopolized factor, M. If no such factor is in the case, no monopoly prices can emerge. The first requirement for monopoly prices is the existence of a monopolized good. If no quantity of such a good, M, is withheld, there is no opportunity for an entrepreneur to substitute monopoly prices for competitive prices. Entrepreneurial profit has nothing at all to do with monopoly. If an entrepreneur is in a position to sell at monopoly prices, he owes this advantage to his monopoly with regard to a monopolized factor, M. He earns the specific monopoly gain from his ownership of M, not from his specific entrepreneurial activities. Let us assume that an accident cuts a city's electrical supply for several days and forces the residents to resort to candlelight only. The price of candles rises to S. At this price, the whole supply available is sold out. The stores selling candles reap a high profit in selling their whole supply at S. But it could happen that the storekeepers combine in order to withhold a part of their stock from the market and to sell the rest at a price of S plus T. While S would have been the competitive price, S plus T is a monopoly price. The surplus earned by the storekeepers at the price S plus T over the proceeds they would have earned when selling at S only is their specific monopoly gain. It is immaterial in what way the storekeepers bring about the restriction of the supply offered for sale. The physical destruction of a part of the supply available is the classical case of monopolistic action. Only a short time ago it was practiced by the Brazilian government in burning large quantities of coffee. But the same effect can be attained by leaving a part of the supply unused. While there constantly prevails a tendency to make profits disappear, the specific monopoly gain is a permanent phenomenon and can disappear only with a change in the market data. While profits are incompatible with the imaginary construction of the evenly rotating economy, monopoly prices and specific monopoly gains are not. 5. The competitive price is determined by the state of the market. There prevails on a competitive market a tendency toward the disappearance of differences in prices and the establishment of a uniform price. With regard to monopoly prices, things are different. If it is possible for the seller to increase his net proceeds by restricting sales and increasing prices per unit sold, then, as a rule, there are several monopoly prices which satisfy this condition. As a rule, one of these monopoly prices yields the highest net proceeds. But it may also happen that various monopoly prices are equally advantageous to the monopolist. We may call this monopoly price, or these monopoly prices, most advantageous to the monopolist, the optimum monopoly price, or the optimum monopoly prices. 6. The monopolist does not know beforehand in what way the consumers will react to a rise in prices. He must resort to trial and error in his endeavors to find out whether the monopolized good can be sold to his advantage at any price exceeding the competitive price, and, if this is so, which of various possible monopoly prices is the optimum monopoly price, or one of the optimum monopoly prices. This is in practice much more difficult than the economist assumes when, in drawing demand curves, he ascribes perfect foresight to the monopolist. We must, therefore, list as a special condition required for the appearance of monopoly prices the monopolist's ability to discover such prices. 7. A special case is provided by the incomplete monopoly. The greater part of the total supply available is owned by the monopolist. The rest is owned by one or several men who are not prepared to cooperate with the monopolist in a scheme for restricting sales and bringing about monopoly prices. However, the reluctance of these outsiders does not prevent the establishment of monopoly prices if the portion P1, controlled by the monopolist, is large enough when compared with the sum of the outsiders' portions, P2. Let us assume that the whole supply, P equals P1 plus P2, can be sold at the price C per unit, and a supply of P minus Z at the monopoly price, D. If D, P1 minus Z, is higher than CP1, it is to the advantage of the monopolist to embark upon a monopolistic restriction of his sales, no matter what the conduct of the outsiders may be. They may go on selling at the price C, or they may raise their prices up to the maximum of D. The only point that counts is that the outsiders are not willing to put up with a reduction in the quantity which they themselves are selling. The whole reduction required must be borne by the owner of P1. This influences his plans and will, as a rule, result in the emergence of a monopoly price, which is different from that which would have been established under complete monopoly. It is obvious that an incomplete monopoly scheme is bound to collapse if the outsiders come into a position to expand their sales. 8. Duopoly and oligopoly are not special varieties of monopoly prices, but merely a variety of the methods applied for the establishment of a monopoly price. Two or several men own the whole supply. They all are prepared to sell at monopoly prices and to restrict their total sales accordingly. But for some reason they do not want to act in concert. Each of them goes his own way without any formal or tacit agreement with his competitors. But each of them knows also that his rivals are intent upon a monopolistic restriction of their sales in order to reap higher prices per unit and specific monopoly gains. Each of them watches carefully the conduct of his rivals and tries to adjust his own plans to their actions. A succession of moves and countermoves, a mutual outwitting, results, the outcome of which depends on the personal cunning of the adverse parties. The duopolists and oligopolists have two objectives in mind: to find out the monopoly price most advantageous to the sellers on the one hand, and to shift as much as possible of the burden of restricting the amount of sales to their rivals. precisely because they do not agree with regard to the quotas of the reduced amount of sales to be allotted to each party, they do not act in concert as the members of a cartel do. One must not confuse duopoly and oligopoly with the incomplete monopoly, or with competition aiming at the establishment of monopoly. In the case of incomplete monopoly, only the monopolistic group is prepared to restrict its sales in order to make a monopoly price prevail. The other sellers decline to restrict their sales. But duopolists and oligopolists are ready to withhold a part of their supply from the market. In the case of price slashing, one group, A, plans to attain full monopoly or incomplete monopoly by forcing all or most of its competitors, the B's, to go out of business. It cuts prices to a level which makes selling ruinous to its more vulnerable competitors. A may also incur losses by selling at this low rate, but it is in a position to undergo such losses for a longer time than the others, and it is confident that it will make good for them later by ample monopoly gains. This process has nothing to do with monopoly prices. It is a scheme for the attainment of a monopoly position. One may wonder whether duopoly and oligopoly are of practical significance. As a rule, the parties concerned will come to at least a tacit understanding concerning their quotas of the reduced amount of sales. 9. The monopolized good by whose partial withholding from the market the monopoly prices are made to prevail can be either a good of the lowest order or a good of a higher order, a factor of production. It may consist in the control of the technological knowledge required for production, the recipe. Such recipes are, as a rule, free goods, as their ability to produce definite effects is unlimited. They can become economic goods only if they are monopolized and their use is restricted. Any price paid for the services rendered by a recipe is always a monopoly price. It is immaterial whether the restriction of a recipe's use is made possible by institutional conditions, such as patents and copyright laws, or by the fact that a formula is kept secret and other people fail to guess it. The complementary factor of production, the monopolization of which can result in the establishment of monopoly prices, may also consist in a man's opportunity to make his cooperation in the production of a good known to consumers, who attribute to this cooperation a special significance. This opportunity may be given either by the nature of the commodities or services in question, or by institutional provisions such as protection of trademarks. The reasons why the consumers value the contribution of a man or a firm so highly are manifold. They may be special confidence placed on the individual or firm concerned on account of previous experience, merely baseless prejudice or error, snobbishness, magic or metaphysical prepossessions whose groundlessness is ridiculed by more reasonable people. A drug marked by a trademark may not differ in its chemical structure and its physiological efficacy from other compounds not marked with the same label. However, if the buyers attach a special significance to this label and are ready to pay higher prices for the product marked with it, the seller can, provided the configuration of demand is propitious, reap monopoly prices. The monopoly which enables the monopolist to restrict the amount offered without counteraction on the part of other people can consist in the greater productivity of a factor which he has at his disposal, as against the lower productivity of the corresponding factor at the disposal of his potential competitors. If the margin between the higher productivity of his supply of the monopolized factor and that of his potential competitors is broad enough for the emergence of a monopoly price, a situation results which we may call margin monopoly. The use of this term margin monopoly is, like that of any other, quite optional. It would be vain to object that every other monopoly which results in monopoly prices could also be called a margin monopoly. Let us illustrate margin monopoly by referring to its most frequent instance in present-day conditions, the power of a protective tariff to generate a monopoly price under special circumstances. Atlantis puts a tariff, T, on the importation of each unit of the commodity P, the world market price of which is S. If domestic consumption of P in Atlantis at the price S plus T is A, and domestic production of P is B, B being smaller than A, then the costs of the marginal dealer are S plus T. The domestic plants are in a position to sell their total output at the price S plus T. The tariff is effective and offers to domestic business the incentive to expand the production of P from B to a quantity slightly smaller than A. But if B is greater than A, things are different. If we assume that B is so large that even at the price S, domestic consumption lags behind it, and the surplus must be exported and sold abroad, the imposition of a tariff does not affect the price of P. Both the domestic and the world market price of P remain unchanged. However, the tariff, in discriminating between domestic and foreign production of P, accords to the domestic plants a privilege which can be used for a monopolistic combine, provided certain further conditions are present. If it is possible to find within the margin between S plus T and S a monopoly price, it becomes lucrative for the domestic enterprises to form a cartel. The cartel sells in the home market of Atlantis at a monopoly price and disposes of the surplus abroad at the world market price. Of course, as the quantity of P offered at the world market increases as a consequence of the restriction of the quantity sold in Atlantis, the world market price drops from S to S1. It is, therefore, a further requirement for the emergence of the domestic monopoly price that the total restriction in proceeds resulting from this fall in the world market price is not so great as to absorb the whole monopoly gain of the domestic cartel. In the long run, such a national cartel cannot preserve its monopolistic position if entrance into its branch of production is free to newcomers. The monopolized factor, the services of which the cartel restricts, as far as the domestic market is concerned, for the sake of monopoly prices, is a geographical condition which can easily be duplicated by every new investor who establishes a new plant within the borders of Atlantis. Under modern industrial conditions, the characteristic feature of which is steady technological progress, the latest plant will, as a rule, be more efficient than the older plants and produce at lower average costs. The incentive to prospective newcomers is therefore twofold. It consists not only in the monopoly gain of the cartel members, but also in the possibility of outstripping them by lower costs of production. Here again, institutions come to the aid of the old firms that form the cartel. The patents give them a legal monopoly, which nobody may infringe. Of course, only some of their production processes may be protected by patents. But a competitor who is prevented from resorting to these processes and to the production of the articles concerned may be handicapped in such a serious way that he cannot consider entrance into the field of the cartelized industry.